Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Food, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Tippin, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Connor Picken and Matthew Dischinger, co-editors of the brand new collection, Southern Comforts, Drinking in the U.S. South from Louisiana State University Press. Connor Picken is an assistant professor of English and the faculty director of the Compassio Learning Community at Bellarmine University. His teaching and research encompass 20th and 21st century American literature, Southern literature, modernism, and social change. Matthew Dischinger is a lecturer at Georgia State University. Matt works at the intersections of American studies, Southern studies, and post-colonial studies. His research explores contemporary U.S. multi-ethnic literatures, literary melancholia, and speculative aesthetics. I'm going to ask Matt about that later. Thank you so much, Connor and Matt, for agreeing to speak with me on the podcast.
Thank you, Carrie.
Yeah, thanks. Happy to be here.
So this is the New Books in Food podcast, and while alcohol is certainly a key interest in food studies, neither of you really identify as working in that field. Instead, you both kind of describe yourself as primarily Southern studies. Is that true?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah. So this episode will definitely be cross-listed on the New Books in the American South channel. So if you're listening from that channel, thanks for joining us. So I'll ask you first, Connor, how did you come to working on a book about alcohol in Southern culture? What are some of the backgrounds, the academic backgrounds that you bring to the project?
Well, I think it would probably start sort of anecdotally. I grew up in the Midwest. I attended a small liberal arts college in Kentucky that was in a dry county. At the time, that meant very little to me. But in hindsight, after kind of bouncing around the South post-graduation, doing the graduate school odyssey, noticing what seemed to be kind of silly or arbitrary or just kind of like inexplicable, like alcohol and consumption laws, that was probably embedded somewhere in my subconscious, always curious about how and why that was the case. But the real genesis of this whole project was I was very fortunate when I was getting my master's to be placed in as a TA for a big, like early American lit gen ed course. And it was with a guy named John Crowley, who turned out to be a mentor of mine. And John, a lot of his scholarly background was on temperance literature. And I ended up taking a Faulkner seminar with him that spring, and I read his book. His book is called The White Logic, Alcoholism in American Modernist Fiction, something like that. And I remember reading the book, being very kind of drawn into the subject matter and thinking back on some of those curiosities that I had from the undergraduate years and beyond. And one of the things that John told me, he said, I never really had a toehold on how I could implicate Faulkner in this kind of broader argument that I've made. So we were reading Sanctuary at the time in that class. And so he's like, why don't you try to figure out kind of within the scaffolding of this argument, how Sanctuary might fit into it. And so that became the paper and sort of the idea that I hitched my wagon to and have not unhitched in many respects. And then when I was at LSU, doing my dissertation, the idea, I mean, you want to talk about sort of oddities in the drinking culture. I mean, just spent some time in South Louisiana. So that very much, you know, kind of substantiated some of the curiosities that I'd had all along. And then being at a school and a department that emphasized Southern studies, Southern culture, I was able to kind of look at this idea of drinking and alcohol and alcoholism in Southern literature and culture beyond just kind of the Faulkner lens. And that became my dissertation. And then, of course, as I'm sure folks can certainly understand, I mean, conferencing these papers and trying to get these papers published. I mean, you're sort of, you know, riding a particular hobby horse for a long time. This sort of became my identity, my scholarly identity, more or less. And then the opportunity came from some folks at LSU Press to put a collection together. I mean, so this is one of the things, Carrie, that I've found, and I think Matt would probably agree. If you know, say, hey, what are you studying in grad school, or what's your paper about? If you say anything about like booze and the South, everyone has a reaction. You know, I mean, if I'd said like, you know, I don't know, 19th century French poetics or something, then you'd get that sort of, you know, that 1,000-yard stare. But everyone had a reaction to this. So I knew that it was a subject matter that at least kind of inspired curiosity in people. And sure enough, there was interest from the press. And here we are, 4 short years later, after the wheels started turning for the edited collection.
Yeah. So Matt, how did you come to the project? What are sort of the academic backgrounds that shape your contributions?
Yeah. So, I mean, my story is very different from Connor's, except that we both came through LSU for our doctoral work. But I, you know, I work in Southern studies. I wrote a dissertation on melancholia in contemporary Southern lit. Really what I was doing in the project was trying to think about what aesthetics kind of are used to constitute Southern literature. So like, what does it mean that so many books about the South or from the South are focused around loss? So my dissertation was about that question, and I looked at contemporary literature that seemed to refute the stakes of the question. And I guess that's the connection between that project and the edited collection, Southern Comforts, for me anyway, is that, you know, I tend to, in a lot of my work, kind of look at literature more telescopically than microscopically. So sort of like from above, and try to figure out like what various movements mean. So I was really interested in, you know, how drinking connects to maybe a more robust discussion in food studies in the South, and how it kind of helps us understand you know, Southern literature and culture better. You know, it wasn't, in other words, so my part in the project, you know, wasn't to kind of think back on my dissertation in any particular way about drinking, because it wasn't about that. It was to think about what constitutes the field, how drinking is a kind of consumption that connects to food, but is also sort of different from consumption in food, and how it sort of responds back to some of the trends in Southern studies that I'm interested in and wrestle with in most of my work.
Yeah, so maybe you can both give a little bit of an answer to this, but what are sort of the fields or backgrounds that the contributors kind of represent? Are they mostly from literary studies, Southern studies, or maybe food and foodways studies?
I would say mostly from literary studies and Southern studies, Carrie. I mean, kind of looking down the roster, there's a couple of folks who were kind of on our radar as we started to strategize how we would get certain kinds of essays, certain scholarly lenses to bring to bear on the project. There's one person in particular, kind of outside of our field, a scholar named Susan Zeger, who teaches out at UC Riverside. She's one of the big hitters in what has kind of been broadly defined as alcohol and addiction studies. I don't know that she would necessarily wear that hat, but she wrote a book that came out, I don't know, 10 years ago or so, that was kind of a field defining work that sort of took the work of Crowley, who I mentioned earlier, and some others, and advanced it like 5 generations. So she is one who I bet, you know, folks who are, you know, into the Southern studies scene and who read the Southern literary studies stuff from LSU Press, that I'd be willing to bet people don't necessarily will not be totally familiar with her work. But I'd say for the most part, Matt, correct me if I'm wrong, that a lot of the folks are kind of Southernists first and foremost, who have, you know, have varied takes on how alcohol can kind of inform their scholarly apparatus.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I'm just looking down the list as well. And I think there certainly are some folks who work some or even mostly on the subject of food. You know, David Davis is obviously a Southernist, no question about it. But he's edited a collection on food. Hannah Griggs, a graduate student at Emory, has focused a lot of her work on drinking cultures and foodways. Connor mentioned Susan Ziegler, who's sort of a Victorianist and someone who works in addiction studies. So there's definitely the trend in the book is more more towards Southern literary studies, although that to me, and that's the name of the series that we're in at LSU, obviously, that to me can kind of be an outmoded term in some ways. Like, this is a Southern cultural studies book. Even if most of the folks in the book, at least, you know, started in literature and even used literature, it's definitely a cultural studies project. So, I think that's, those are the trends that the contributors fit into.
And I would say, just to piggyback off what Matt just said, Carrie, I mean, one of the interesting things kind of from the bird's eye view about how all the essays sort of speak to one another is that because most of the contributors are in Southern studies, they don't necessarily have the fluency in some of the alcohol and addiction stuff. But as I was trying to say earlier, in terms of how I came to the idea of this project, anyone who's in Southern studies or Southern literary studies, I mean, you're a stone's throw away from like a book or a text about drinking, about alcohol. So I remember early on in our correspondence with some folks, you know, one of the what Matt and I would say was like, hey, Monica Miller, for example, or hey, Katie Burnett, we know that you're, you know, not necessarily alcohol is not necessarily in your wheelhouse, but you're a Southernist. So clearly you've thought about this in some form or fashion, even if you're not writing about it, or even if you're not, you know, if that's not foregrounded in your scholarly discourse. And I think that the fact that there is such close proximity, even if it's not necessarily true 100% of the time, but at least kind of popular conceptions of that proximity between Southern culture, Southern literary studies, and alcohol, that it really kind of the project as a whole kind of flowered, and we see people just latching on to alcohol and addiction and drinking in a whole host of ways, which I think is a really interesting kind of breadth in terms of how folks who, you know, would be more or less branded Southernists are talking about booze, which is, I think, what a collection ideally would do anyway.
Yeah, so I tend to review a lot of single food histories on this podcast. That seems to be like the most active genre in academic kind of food books at the moment, or books that try to tell the history of a place through like a single food item. But that's not exactly what this book is, even though I think some people could look at the cover and maybe think that. So there are definitely some essays that are cultural histories. There's some that are very clearly literary analyses with a historical bent. So how would you describe it? Maybe Matt, I'll start with you. It's an edited collection, an analysis of narrative representations of drinking in the South. How else would you kind of describe it to people who haven't read it yet?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good description, the one that you just offered. If we look at the way that the collection breaks down in terms of its organization, so we have three parts. The first is alcoholism, temperance, and the South. The second is revising narrative through intoxication. And the third is alcohol's production, commodification, and circulation in the South. And I think those are... within each one of those sort of thematic sections, we have the kind of breakdowns that you just offered. Folks doing, you know, literary analysis and history, you know, folks like I mentioned Hannah Griggs and her essays in the third section, and it's a sort of cultural history of this cocktail in New Orleans called the Ohen cocktail. But that collection also has, you know, work, Jenna Shuto, wrote an essay on Faulkner's representations of bootlegging, for example. So that's more literary analysis and history. But thematically, I guess to go back to what I started off saying, thematically, I think the collection breaks down in terms of, some big ways that we think about drinking in the South. Right. So one is through, you know, in part one, alcoholism on one end and sort of complete, you know, teetotaling, you know, abstinent, you know, that stance toward temperance, that's the word I'm looking for, temperance in the South. So like the sort of extremes that we see. And part two is really about how intoxication as a theme both gets narrativized and kind of changes the way that we think about narrative. And Monica Miller and Zach Vernon, for example, are really interested in the sort of narrative tendencies of writing and thinking about drinking and what those mean for, on the one hand for Zach, you know, cinema, and Monica's interested in Flannery O'Connor and the way that her narratives kind of, use drinking as a kind of theme to kind of bounce up against. And then finally, in the last section, production, commodification, circulation. I mean, those essays are definitely geared more towards the kind of material reality of alcohol and how it's moved around, how that gets represented in literature, but also how it exists in print culture. And Jenny Lightwise Goff, I'm just thinking about her essay at the very end of the book, you know, how drinking becomes a kind of way for people to talk and think about the South. And she's focused on kind of disaster capitalism after Katrina through the rhetoric of George W. Bush. But she goes a lot of different places with that essay. So, I mean, I think the way that you set it up is great. And it's what we do. But to do that, we sort of organize three parts of the book around sort of three different ways that people think and talk about drinking.
Yeah, Connor, anything you want to add to that?
No, I mean, I think Matt hit the nail on the head. I mean, the part one, the alcoholism and temperance. I mean, what's interesting about how that we ended up framing that section, Carrie, is it necessarily speaks to or kind of defines drinking in the South through binaries, which are things that, I mean, binaries are not necessarily, I mean, it's not necessarily an intellectually responsible way to think about it. Nevertheless, if you're talking about drinking in the South, a knee-jerk reaction is like, you know, the wild boys or the hell of a fella versus kind of the teetotaling fundamentalist. But I think embedded within those binaries is a very unique and interesting kind of cultural and political history and discourse that has long informed Southern culture. So it's not just about, you know, temperance or prohibition, for example, but the kind of cultural artifacts that inform why those binaries exist, why one would think of the alcohol as a place, or I'm sorry, the South as a place that is both sort of soaked, a landscape soaked in alcohol, and also a landscape that's so brittle and dry that you know, no one would dare drink here. And then I think the narrative through intoxication, I mean, one of the really interesting three lines on those essays is just the way that, I mean, so how do we make sense of narratives where characters are imbibing heavily? What is it like in a more kind of modernist sense where, you know, subjectivity is privileged throughout the narrative and this person is clearly under the influence of alcohol? And then part three, again, the risk of redundancy here. Alcohol is kind of a material artifact. Like it's a thing, right? It's produced, it's bought, it's sold, it's exchanged, it's labeled in a particular way. And because the South, I realize that's a kind of a problematic geospatial demarcation, but nevertheless, I mean, what we traditionally think of as the Southeast, it kind of looks like a patchwork or a quilt of like wet and dry, This happens here, Appalachia's over there. I mean, the whole bird's eye view of the South in terms of how alcohol crosses borders, what the implications are of that. And then, of course, the last three essays that deal specifically with material artifact of booze in New Orleans, which, as I mentioned earlier, kind of has a whole other host of connotations to it. These are, honestly, Carrie, three of probably many ways to think about how you can categorize or understand drinking and alcohol in the South. But we found for the purposes of framing the book in a particular way, that these essays more or less kind of leaned in a particular direction. And for the time being, anyway, this seems a way to cover the ground necessary.
Well, that leads me to kind of my next question about the idea of a monolithic Southern identity. Seems to be something that you're definitely questioning in this work, and most Southern studies does. One of the things about the rhetoric of food and drink that always kind of bothers me, you have the same complaint, is that drinking culture, as you write in the book, whitewashes histories of inequality while trumpeting the community-affirming possibilities of a mixed drink. And you really got me on this series of questions, too. Consumption of food and drink might reenact community, but what kind of community is it? And from where did that community arise? And who might be excluded from that community? So talk a little bit more about how this focus on alcohol helps you kind of question or trouble the idea of Southern identity or belonging. Matt, let's start with you.
Sure. Yeah, those were definitely key questions for us right from the outset. And just to kind of agree with you in a slightly different way, I think part of our interest at the outset in the project was to take something that is, take drinking, which is very like ubiquitous and kind of overdetermined in the South, especially through its most visible forms, some of which we already mentioned. But also through, you know, hard drinking authors and, these kind of like mythic versions of white masculinity in particular. But I think that's one example of a kind of a cliche about Southern literature in particular and the South more generally. And we wanted to, you know, sort of completely, I guess, not completely ignore those concepts, but to take them and take them apart through work that was much more specific and historical and interested in the kinds of community that drinking moves through and reveals. So to go back to your question or the questions that we raise in the intro, I think what's interesting about drinking, and we say this there, but I think what's interesting about drinking is that it does seem to maybe be more suited or better suited to help us think about the act of consumption critically. I think and I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts about this too, Carrie. But it seems like with food, one of the ways that I've thought about food as a kind of consumption that can often be kind of flattened or sometimes be flattened in food studies as this sort of benign, benevolent thing. I mean, maybe part of the reason that happens is because, you know, food, you know, eating is itself reparative, right? You know, I mean, mm-hmm. If you sit around a table and eat with people, then it feels like something profound is happening. And maybe even it is, you know? But there's also something that's being covered up, right? You know, to someone who works in on class, you might call that like the means of production of that food. But that, of course, also resonates with racial histories and gendered histories anywhere, but especially in the South. And drinking is, it's certainly more complicated than eating in some other ways, but it doesn't have the same sort of reparative function. You know, I mean, there's something kind of like, in a kind of literal way, bad about drinking, right? You know, if you drink too much, and I suppose this is true if you eat too much, but if you drink too much, you're thinking less clearly. It's bad for your body. There's no sustenance that happens through drinking. So it would seem maybe in that way to offer the opportunity to kind of speak back to a trend in food studies to see eating as this kind of positive thing, right? A kind of consumption that for people who work in cultural studies departments and think a lot about consumption in terms of like watching television or movies or reading books or consuming print culture, right? Like those are all kinds of consumption that I think from the outset we are suspicious of, right? But it seems like in more literal forms of consumption, like eating and even drinking, we tend to think a bit less critically about what they mean and a bit more sort of optimistically about their potential to just sort of be good. So again, part of what we're trying to do, and I think so many of the essays do this in a variety of ways, is to look at how complicated and charged the act of drinking has been and how meaningful it has been. And I can think of lots of examples, but I want to hear what Connor says about this too.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Okay, Connor, let's hear your answer.
Well, I think that, I agree with everything Matt said. You mentioned the idea of kind of understanding or characterizing the South as it relates to drinking monolithically. I mean, even if we, which of course is irresponsible and not right, not true, I should say, but through the lens of alcohol and drinking, I mean, even if we do look at monolithic representations or understandings of the South. So for example, we talk about this a little bit in the introduction, but this sort of there's like this celebratory gesture of kind of elevating the stature of Southern writers and Southern writing and Southern culture based on how much basically old white men like Faulkner would drink, right? I mean, it's kind of become circumscribed around this like mythology of gentlemen who could hold their alcohol. So I would call that sort of a knee-jerk, monolithic, kind of one-dimensional view of the correlation between alcohol and drinking in the South. But so even if we don't want to get more complicated than that, if you just look at what is not being explained, so if we would just flip that coin over and looked at the other side, someone like Faulkner, what we don't necessarily talk about would be, well, like, what were the consequences of this particular kind of lifestyle? How did this affect his family? How did this affect him as a person? How might we see this resonate in different places in the writing? And at the risk of kind of slipping down this hole of like the author function, But I mean, in the Blattner biography about Faulkner, there's all kinds of references to how problematic his drinking was. Yet that was never really excavated beyond just the level of observation. And so, if we were to look at how that sort of other flip side of a particular coin can be a means to understand a different kind of community, Faulkner's wife dried out. She was a problem drinker. One might even say an alcoholic. And you know how she got sober, Carrie? She went to AA. And she was a woman in North Mississippi in the middle part of the 20th century in a boys club, which is what AA in the South was at the time. And we don't even necessarily think about that. So we haven't even necessarily, gone down the different rabbit holes that the essay explores. But my point in this kind of elongated anecdote here is just to say that even if we do focus just on sort of the knee-jerk understandings and representations of alcohol in the South, if you just look at it from a slightly different angle, there is so much that has not necessarily been talked about that I think is beneficial for the field and beneficial to challenge those monolithic understandings. So that would be kind of one response to what the questions you posed and to Matt's response. The other thing I would say is, well, Matt and I talked about, whose community is it and who does that community exclude? At the risk of kind of beating a dead horse here, there's the popular understandings of alcohol and drinking now, like in 2020, they look a particular way. You see in different kind of print magazines, you see them in different online forums. You know, it's, you know, this really kind of like hyper, kind of bourgeois, like affected, like inflated cultural sensibility of like a Southern cocktail or a Southern drink. And that's awesome. Like it's interesting to think about. It shows how these kind of micro economy. I mean, I live in Louisville, Kentucky, where like the bourbon, you know, bourbon tourism is a thing. I mean, I went to Maker's Mark this past summer, Carrie, to do a tour. And my family was probably the only ones like in our group who spoke English. I mean, people from all over the world coming to check this stuff out, but cashing in on that, necessarily brands it in a particular way that doesn't necessarily link responsibly to ways that the industry itself got off the ground, you know, hundreds of years ago, right? And who was responsible for the labor to produce the booze way back in the day. You're also talking about a region with a very complicated, one might say hypocritical, kind of cultural and political history as it relates to the legality of alcohol. And that legality oftentimes looked the other way, depending on what you looked like. You know, if you had white skin or light skin, or you had dark skin. And so this alcohol and drinking for us, I think, throughout the course of putting this collection together and researching how we wanted to approach the introduction, in many ways, it does what a lot of singular approaches to looking at Southern culture and literature revealed, which is, there's a lot of interesting kind of side history with this, but it also is another means by which we can think critically about histories of inequality in the region. And even though we are, you know, we can all get on board with like this really cool artisan cocktail with this like really cool branding and this interesting brand that's put in an ice cube to show that this distillery does things a certain way, like that's fun, but it's also, it kind of like willfully ignores other systemic histories of inequality that I think we can read through the lens of alcohol and drinking.
Yeah. Speaking of that, I think what you're alluding to is that story in the introduction about Jack Daniels. Yeah. So tell us a little bit more about that. How does that represent the kind of mythologizing and inequality that the collection is trying to undermine?
This is not picking on Jack Daniels by any means, but I mean, if you think sort of Southern, what you think alcohol, whiskey, Tennessee, I mean, Jack Daniels is, I mean, that's the big dog, right? And only recently has it been sort of rediscovered that the first master distiller at Jack Daniels was a former enslaved man named Nearest Green. And there were a couple of New York Times articles, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, that sort of brought back to life this notion that like the Jack Daniels brand had, there was a long history of either like purposefully ignoring that or just not bringing it to light. But Jack Daniels as a person has this interesting kind of mythology and history behind him. And of course the brand, the way that the brand is marketed does that as well. But you know who actually got him started? A former enslaved man. And we should be talking about that too. And I think to their credit, Jack Daniels has embraced this history. And we talk about that a little bit in the introduction. But just the fact that it was not necessarily a part of the history for so long, Carrie, that blind spot is important for, I think, for folks to shine a little bit of light on and understanding what that means, what the implications are. And I think it should also bring to the forefront to anyone who's intellectually curious, what other Nearest Green stories are there out there, you know, as it pertains to like these giant, you know, transnational brands that ship and distill all over the world. And I'm speculating that like Jim Beam, for example, would have that. But nevertheless, the Jack Daniel example with Nearest Green, I think sort of embodies the kind of critical work that we hope that the collection would do, which is to say, here's a particular history and mythology of an iconic Southern drink or a booze that is distilled in the South. But like two or three layers behind the history that you see when you pull up the Jack Daniels website is something very important that has linkages to chattel slavery, economic exploitation, racism, so forth and so on.
Yeah, Matt, are there any other sort of myths that you think the collection is doing a good job at debunking?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I can think of several essays in the collection that sort of bounce off maybe familiar or mythical histories. I believe it's the first essay in the collection by Ali Arendt about Black blues women and drinking. And I suppose in Ali's essay, she's interested in how drinking is, and I think this cannot be disentangled from the mythology of the hard drinking man in the South, but that drinking is this kind of, since it's coded as masculine, it's a kind of consumption that isn't open to women, or that when it's performed by women, it signifies, a range of other, sexualized kinds of consumption. And Ali does this really excellent job, kind of teasing out how Black blues women kind of play with this notion of like over sexualized consumption, through their music and try to use, in other words, use a sort of mythical and I guess more like mythologized is probably the better word there, but use a sort of mythologized foundation to kind of speak back to it and consider the politics of that myth. And if we turn from Ali's essay to the final essay in the collection, which I've already mentioned, by Jenny Lightwise Goff on a kind of feminized version of New Orleans as a place where men come to get drunk. She's bouncing off of George W. Bush's remarks after Katrina, and his sort of like posturing about how New Orleans was a place that, he sort of suggestively makes the remark that New Orleans was a place where he had fun. So kind of casting New Orleans as this like feminized space for men to drink too much, and to do a host of other things, right? I think we can see through just the first and the last essay the way that this kind of like mythology works across time, and isn't necessarily really going anywhere. And I could probably say more about how other essays in the collection do this too, but I think that's a big one for us too. I mean, the drinking and gender in the South and all the sort of the way that questions about drinking, gender, and race get sort of mangled together and kind of work to support one another. I guess that's what I mean. And I think that's what the book does really interestingly is it tries to disentangle and specify and historicize really tangled up myths that kind of connect in interesting ways.
Well, you've both mentioned lots of pieces from the book, but Connor, are there any must reads? Would you maybe point out a few that you really liked or that you think make a really important contributions to the conversation?
Sure. This would be like saying you're picking your favorite child. I mean that with the utmost degree of sincerity. I mean, we spent so much time with these, Carrie, that, we feel some kind of ownership and kinship to all of them. I mean, just off the top, I mean, I'll just kind of give you one from each section. I mentioned Susan Seegers earlier. I mean, she's a powerhouse, but Kara Kohler's, it's an essay called It's Either the Candy or the Hooch. And it's about Orson Welles's film Touch of Evil that takes place on the US-Mexico border. It's just an interesting kind of cinematic understanding of the border and how the border represents different kind of locus of power relative to which side of the border you're on. And that the protagonist is drunk pretty much throughout the entire film. In the second section, I think that Caleb Doan and Jerry Kennedy's essay on Poe is really good. Because we wanted engagement with the canon. They're really, really kind of smart and insightful reads of a breadth of Poe's work. That, you know, Poe is someone who is characterized fairly or not as kind of a fall down alcoholic, and the unreliability of the narrators that are, is oftentimes fairly or not kind of projected onto him oftentimes has to do with intoxication or some sort of altered state of mind. And then, I mean, at the risk of again, being redundant here, Jenny Lightwise Goff's, W's Good Time that Matt has mentioned a couple of times. It's a devastating coda to the collection. She's a beautiful writer, writes in this kind of lyrical style. That's good. And then the other one I would say, Chris Rieger's In the Last Section too. He talks about, he brings Ernest Hemingway into a conversation about Southern writers, which we don't necessarily always think of him in that way. But he does an interesting kind of contrast or juxtaposition between bootlegging in Florida, between Marjorie Kennan Rawlings and Ernest Hemingway. And that was very insightful as well. And again, and I'm not just saying this, Carrie, I mean, this is, you put me on the spot. Those are a couple that jumped out, but there's other ones too.
Yeah. Matt, would you add anything else to that list?
Yeah. I just said, first of all, I would put everything on that list. A lot of these essays have come up in small ways. I really think, and I'll start from section three, where you just ended up, Connor, I really think Hannah Griggs's essay on the Ohen cocktail is kind of a must read, particularly for folks in food studies. Because I think it's one of the essays that is most, I guess, structurally and formally familiar, since that's the framework that Hannah works in a lot, I think. It's a great cultural history, but I think it's also a really important cultural history of taking this sort of weird object, and I'll just say briefly that the Ohen cocktail is based on a kind of liqueur that's sort of like absinthe that was really popular in the Jim Crow South, but for a long time didn't exist. I think the Sazerac Company has recently brought it back. But in this kind of, which is itself kind of important, I think, after you read Hannah's essay, because the Ohen cocktail, was kind of consumed in important and exclusionary ways. And I think, her essay helps us think about, how something like, bringing back an old object in this kind of nostalgic way, can be both attractive and also, cover up over a history that is really interesting and complicated. So Hannah's essay, which is called Jim Crow, Mardi Gras, and the Ohen Cocktail is definitely a must read. I would add a few others that are, also like, among many great essays. I think Katie Burnett's essay in part two, Revising Narrative Through Intoxication, she's really, Katie is a 19th centuryist and, or sort of an early Americanist, I should say. And she, reads back into early Virginia literature about, how drinking becomes a way for people to think and talk about the sort of economic operation of the plantation. In many ways, her piece kind of doesn't fit with a lot of the other essays in the collection, in that it's, it sort of shows, a version of drinking that doesn't at least immediately and obviously square with some of the myths that we've been talking about. But it's a fascinating essay, and I think she explores like a register for thinking and talking about drinking and temperance over consumption. That is a really essential contribution to the book. In the first section, I feel like we've talked about almost every essay here in some capacity, but so I'll drop in one more, Matthew Sutton's book, essay, The Tennessee Two-Step, Narrating Recovery and Country Music Autobiography. It's a really attentive and excellent essay on how country music male stars are mythologized through their own sort of explanations of how they drank and how they quit, both as like sort of important important steps in a kind of mythology. I mean, I think that's his area. I mean, he's kind of a music historian. He kind of coins a new term, the Tennessee two-step, I may be getting some of the details wrong from this. But what's called two-stepping, or, you know, skipping from kind of admitting you have a problem to the end of the 12-step process, in AA. So he kind of examines how country music autobiography does this and kind of mythologizes this move, as a part of, you know, the hard drinking male, Southerner who's in the country music industry. Those three essays are really, really fantastic.
So inevitably any collection is going to have gaps also. So what might not be included that readers would expect to find, or are there other viewpoints on drinking in the U.S. South that maybe haven't been represented?
Oh yeah.
Maybe Connor first.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, reminds me of what my dissertation director said, which is, you know, get ready for every paper you deliver and every defense of your work. The initial question is, so why didn't you include X, Y, and Z? That's a perfectly legitimate point to make here. I mean, the number of texts from people of color is admittedly smaller than we wish it to be. I mean, this still, I think we're the collection very much exists in the pocket in terms of just a brief perusal of the table of contents, and I would argue that most folks with any kind of background in Southern literary studies or culture would know most, if not all, of the texts or writers. So I think that it's like I was kind of speaking to earlier, Carrie, it's that the blind spots that we don't even know are there because they're blind spots. I mean, so there could be I could imagine a second collection where the, you know, any of us would open the table of contents and say, well, I've heard of one or two of these and that's it. So I think that this would just be, you know, kind of an entry point into hopefully a much more, you know, kind of sprawling excavation of Southern literary and cultural histories that we don't even necessarily know are there yet. So, that's kind of my knee jerk to the
Matt, question. What do you think? Any other gaps or?
Yeah, I mean, just to, I mean, I would echo what Connor said and add to it. I think there's, you know, our introduction starts to kind of consider how contemporary economies of like craft and boutique drinking are really meaningful. Although most of the work in the collection is not really about that. You know, I mean, I think it's something that we address early on and start to consider, but I would have loved to included, you know, someone writing about the sort of contemporary fascination with craft breweries. I live in Atlanta and, it feels like there's a brewery in every neighborhood, but it's like two or three. And beyond that, there's, in most places, I mean, Louisville is a different kind of place, but, kind of craft liquor is a growing industry, all over the place, certainly not just the South, but in the South. I'm really Connor mentioned this early on, I think in our conversation that we're, in the introduction, we sort of think about what, representations of drinking look like and might mean today. And I would love to see someone write, a kind of critical and attentive piece about how kind of like popular and I was going to say boutique-y, but really, I'm talking about like, a kind of a bespoke drinking culture that is growing and has been growing for some time. Particularly, you know, this is something I've thought about a lot and think about all the time in Atlanta. Like I said, just because it's such an obvious trend here. So yeah, I mean, that's just to supplement, I think Connor's excellent point about, you know, the blind spots in terms of texts that the book includes, you know, also, you know, skewing even, I mean, I'm a contemporary lit person, so I tend to always skew towards the contemporary. And that's one way that I would, or that's one kind of essay that I would really be enthusiastic to read.
Well, I'm on it. Okay. I'll let you know.
Yeah, please.
and I'll ask you both maybe as like the last couple of questions. What do you think is maybe the future of Southern food and drink studies? What are maybe some of the next areas that Southern studies or Southern food scholars can and should direct their attention to? Connor, why don't you go first?
I mean, this may be a little repetitive, Carrie, but I think it's being attentive and intentional about finding marginalized voices that we don't necessarily know about right now. I don't know how to. I don't have the prescription for the directions for how to go about you know, locating these voices, for example. But I think that it's. I mean, just to kind of keep it on the topic of the book. I mean, if we're talking about, I mean, I read an article after Matt and I were done with the introduction that talked about this sort of unspoken history of Black bootleggers in Appalachia. So for example, another way that, kind of broader understandings of food, I'm sorry, of alcohol and consumption in the South, we never think about it in this other way. So, it's being intentional and focused about figuring out ways to excavate those voices, and I think just having different voices in the conversation would show how a conversation about alcohol and drinking, for example, could really expand in cool and unexpected and necessary ways.
Yeah, Matt, what do you think about sort of future directions?
Yeah, it's such a great question, and I don't. You know, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's always a little bit, I'm always a little bit tenuous in trying to understand the future, you know, before it arrives. I mean, I'll just tell a quick story that kind of supplements Connor's point or that fits in, because I think, my big comment is that I think the future of you know, food studies and drinking studies, to the extent that it continues to grow, is going to be similar to the future of, you know, literary and cultural studies writ large, you know, not necessarily separate. I mean, all the things that Connor was just mentioning, I think are the future of basically every cultural studies field. But this last summer I was a participant in an NEH summer institute on Jewish history in the South. And it was an excellent couple of weeks in Charleston, you know, learning from mostly historians. And as a literary scholar, you know, it might seem obvious that we would collaborate with historians, but it doesn't happen as much as you might think, or at least it doesn't happen with me as much as I would think and hope. And we ended the couple of weeks we were there with a kind of like Southern Jewish fusion meal, and it was delicious, and it was interesting, and it was you know, historicized, you know, I also left thinking like that was an example of you know, maybe, I mean, in some ways kind of like a best case scenario for consumption as a kind of reparative and I guess critical act, because we were very attentive to the, I mean, almost any register that you could think about food, you know, where the food came from, how it was harvested, the history of specific items and ingredients that went into each dish. And the same was true for our drinks. So it was, I mean, it was a really, kind of intense experience, to be honest, but also a really interesting one, and a history that I think, you know, in Southern studies, you know, I'll just speak for myself. It was largely pretty new to me, so and really educational in that way. So I think that the future of drinking and food studies is going to be expansive. You know, it just has to continue to expand. And while also being, I think, attentive and intentional about what that expansion means. And just to circle back really briefly, because one of the blind spots of the book and is also perhaps in some ways a blind spot for the field or a spot that is maybe increasingly less blind, is a kind of a post-national version of the South. You know, I mean, our book is called Drinking and the U.S. South. You know, we're very clear about, you know, what our book is going to attempt to do. But if we, you know, if we changed it to Drinking in the Hemispheric South, we would have a whole host of other, cultural artifacts to examine and consider. So as the field continues to change, I think constantly redefining what we think the South is and why the South is even a helpful or useful unit of measure, a good scale to work at, maybe sometimes it is and other times it isn't. I think that's an important question that we should be thinking about, like I said, across literary and cultural studies and foodways as part of that.
Well said. So what are you working on now, Connor?
All the things that Matt and I just said that we wish this did, we're working on that right now. The last vestige of my graduate work, there's one more chapter for my dissertation that I've not gone back to in a long time, 7 or 8 years, and I want to go back to that. It's a study on drinking and some of the works set in the South by Cormac McCarthy, specifically the relationship between social class and alcoholism in one of his novels called Sutri. So that's what I have cooking, at least as I sit here right now, thinking what I really want to get to this summer. But part of it too is as Matt kind of alluded to, just sort of this exhale now that the book is actually out. That's a really good question, Carrie. And maybe when I see you in Arkansas next month for the conference, I'll have a better crafted answer.
Sounds good. Matt, what are you up to?
Yeah. So I am, I've got a couple things going and, I'm sort of turning back to, some of my, I guess, more literary work, which sounds pretentious. I didn't mean for it to. I just mean like work about literature and books. I have a kind of a book length project underway on I mentioned this at the outset, but melancholia as a kind of more complex version of more flattening terms like loss and nostalgia. So that project is. It's focused on contemporary literature mostly, but it's interested in what aesthetics have constituted Southern literature over time at its kind of foundations in the 20th century, and of course those are not its full foundations, right? But its kind of modern foundations and modernist foundations and into the present. You know, how has a book performed its Southernness, and what does that mean for contemporary literature, or how is that meaningful or interesting for contemporary literature? So that project is underway with some writers that I think people would know, like Colson Whitehead and others that may be less known, like Cynthia Shearer and Brad Weiss. That project's underway, and it's going to be a minute, though.
That's great. Well, as Connor alluded, we're going to be taking this show on the road very soon. So if any of our listeners are attending the Society for the Study of Southern Literature Conference in April, they can find us at noon on Saturday for the roundtable Beyond Moonshiners, Outlaws, and Teetotalers, Drinking in the U.S. South. So I will be helping to moderate, and we'll have Connor and Matt and a bunch of the contributors as well. So today we've been talking to Connor Picken and Matthew Dischinger, co-editors of the brand new collection, Southern Comforts, Drinking in the U.S. South from LSU Press. Thank you both so much for talking to me today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Carrie.
And I look forward to seeing you soon.
Yep, likewise.